sometime you should go through that song and try to count the Hebrews references. It's really interesting how many verses of that song draw from the book of Hebrews. His oath, his covenant, his blood, support me in the whelming flood. My anchor holds within the veil. There's a lot of really cool references that all tie back to the book of Hebrews in that song, and that's where we're at tonight. We're going to be entering a new section of the book. I know it's been a little while since we've studied, but very brief review. This book is being written to the Jewish Christians who were being tempted not so much to turn back to Judaism, as we saw in our introduction, because they were still practicing Jews, but to let go of Jesus, to let go of the new covenant that they had been given. And so the Hebrew writer has been laying out his argument with different applications within that text. So kind of his main argument kind of goes up here, his applications have been down here, and then it kind of ends with a larger application section, which of course there's teachings within all of it. But we've talked already about in chapters 1 and 2 that Jesus is greater than the angels and the Torah, which I don't know if we talked about that in that section, but the Torah is the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible. It's what they sometimes call the books of Moses, or the Torah. And then in chapter 3 and 4, at least the beginning of 4, we have Jesus being greater than Moses and greater than the rest that Joshua gave them, Canaan, that he's greater than what even Moses and Joshua gave them when the children of Israel first came into the land. And we've been talking for quite a while. The rest of chapter 4, chapter 5, 6, and 7 really centers around Jesus as our high priest. And chapter 8, verse 1 is really going to kind of sum up all of that for us and says, we have such a high priest, referring to mainly what he's just said in chapter 7, but really all the things from chapter 4, 14 and onward have really centered around that role of Jesus. And so here in chapter 8, which is what we're going to be studying tonight, if you want to open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 8, we're going to be focusing here tonight on Jesus introducing a new covenant and then him being superior to the Old Testament tabernacle and the sacrifices offered at that tabernacle. So this will be our focus tonight. As we begin, let's read Hebrews chapter 8, and we're going to read verses 1 through 6. And what he does here is he really summarizes what he has said specifically in the last chapter, and he introduces what he's going to really say for the next couple of chapters. Hebrews chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. So as we look at the first three verses of this, again, it's really cool sometimes when the Bible outlines itself for you. There's a few instances where you can do that, where like the verses just kind of set out what he's about to say. And I think this is one of those sections. In 8:1, as he talks about, we have such a high priest, what chapter has been talking about him being the high priest after the order of Melchizedek? Chapter 7. So he summarizes that and says, we have this high priest, which that should just be a comfort to us. Now, we talked a little bit about this in our application of the last couple of chapters. How often do you think about that you have a high priest at the right hand of God? I don't know about you, but that's not something that is at the forefront of my mind a lot of the time, but that's something that's day in, day out practical for us, because when Jesus is at God's right hand, he's interceding for us. We can go to God at any time in prayer because Jesus is there interceding for us. The Spirit intercedes for us as well, Romans chapter 8. But Jesus is viewed as our mediator, our go-between, our high priest. And that's wonderful. Thank God for such a high priest. In verse 2, I think we have kind of an outline of what he's going to talk about in the next chapter, in chapter 9. He introduces the idea about Jesus ministering in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. And then when you kind of just glance over at chapter 9, starting in verse 1, and like looking down, like what all is he talking about in that chapter when you look through there? He starts to talk about the earthly holy place and like the things in the tabernacle, and he's going to go into like the Day of Atonement and what would happen in the most holy place and all that. So verse 2 kind of introduces the things he'll expand on in chapter 9. And then in verse 3 of chapter 8, he kind of introduces the ideas we're going to see in chapter 10, where it's every high priest, what's one of his jobs? It's going to be to offer these sacrifices. And for him to have these gifts to offer on the altar. And so if you go to chapter 10 and kind of glance through that, he's going to be talking about the offerings and the things that the high priest would offer year after year after year, and how once for all Jesus makes the sacrifice for our sins and makes intercession for us. So that's just kind of cool that this is like one of those sections. This happens in Romans 7, where like there's those two verses that outline chapter the rest of chapter 7 and then chapter 8. I think this is kind of the same thing in the book of Hebrews. Verse 2 is chapter 9, verse 3 is chapter 10. So just a helpful structural thing there. So the first thing that he's going to really focus on as he gets into the next phase of his argument is really the fact that all of these Old Testament things are a shadow. And that's an interesting image that he uses, and it's helpful for us to kind of reflect on that for a moment. What's the idea of a shadow? We're used to shadows, right? And you can look, and like even in here, there's like the shadows of the chairs and like different shadows. The sun comes in here and it casts shadows on things. But a shadow tells you what? That there's like something else nearby, something else there. We just recently had a really cool shadow event, didn't we? The solar eclipse and all that's a really big shadow. And it's amazing how shadows affect us and things like that. So the shadow, though, is not the thing itself. It tells us that the thing is there, right? It sometimes, though, like, how does the shadow point to the thing, though? If you see, like, this really big shadow, like, come over the door, do you think it's, like, Fiona coming up there? It's probably not. It might be Scott, but it's probably not Fiona. And so the shadow of something, to some extent, tells us a few things about what the actual object is, but it's not the actual object. It has kind of the form of the object, the silhouette of it, and you might be able to tell a fair number of things just by the silhouette, but it's kind of two-dimensional, and sometimes it's a little warped. It's like stretched a little bit this way or that way, and so you can't tell exactly what the thing is. Or you couldn't like completely draw, you know, a three-dimensional picture just from the shadow, but it gives you an idea. And so that's really what all these Old Testament images have been: the tabernacle, the priesthood, the sacrifices, Aaron and how that was going to work, Melchizedek, even Moses and Joshua and the land of Canaan and the wilderness. And like, again, we've had lessons here just recently. Scott's kind of gone through some of the timeline thing and looked at just the overwhelming number of shadows we have in the Old Testament. What's relevant about that for the audience that this writer is writing to? Why does he see the need to like tell them, hey, this is a shadow? Because they were enamored with the shadow. And they were just really tempted to forsake the substance to go back to the shadow. And so he tells them, again, in verse 4, or verse 5, they serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. It's just a copy. It's just a shadow. Like when Moses originally got the instructions for that tent, he was saying, like, make it according to the pattern that I showed you on the mountain, but like, it's just a copy. It's just a shadow. It's based on the real thing, but it's not the real thing. Jesus is the real thing, and he entered into the real tabernacle with God himself. And of course, there's just lots more we could say about that, but the point he's making here is just, it's just a shadow. And if I could make an application from that, we don't have inspiredly revealed for us like all the things in this world, but there is a sense in which the things that we experience in this world, even the good things of this world, that are really just a shadow of the good things to come with the Lord. The relationships that we enjoy within our families and within our church family are just a foretaste of our relationship with the Lord in eternity. The beauty of this world and of this creation, even in its broken state, is just a shadow of what the Lord can do in his glory. And I don't know what all that's going to be like, but if the shadow is any indication, it's going to be so much better than anything we can imagine here. But we get so enamored with the shadow sometimes, don't we? We get so caught up, and maybe it's not like the Old Testament thing where like we're tempted to go back to the Old Testament, but even just like the other shadowy things here, that we just get enamored with the here and the now and the pleasures and even the people, that like we're just thinking about the people and we're not really thinking about the one who gave us those people and made those people and in whose image they're made. And we get so enamored with the beauty and the work, the good work that we can do here, that we miss the substance. We miss the longing that we ought to have for the substance. There's a sense in which even though we're in Christ and we're in those heavenly things, that we're still kind of experiencing to some extent a shadow of the things to come in this world. And this concept of those things being a shadow ought to spur us on. It ought to help us to kind of hold with a loose grip onto the good things of this life, because the pleasures here, the beautiful things here, are just a down payment. They're a shadow of the good things to come. We need to be a lot less enamored with this world. Coming back to the text, in verse 6, he makes like, well, this is one of those like classic Hebrews verses, because it's the better verses, right? That's like one of the key words. It's better, it's better, it's better. What three things are better in this verse? He says, but as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. Now, that's kind of a complicated way to say that, but there's three things that are better, right? Jesus has a better ministry, which is kind of through, it's the same amount of better as the covenant is better than the old one. And because the covenant is better because it is enacted on better promises. Now, in chapter 6, if you remember, we've already talked about the better promises, right? That God made a promise and he secured it with an oath, right? So it wasn't like just the promise. It was like he swore by himself, since there's no one greater to swear by. So he just confirmed it. And that's the anchor of our soul. We have hope because of God's promise, because of his oath, you know, his oath, his covenant, his blood, support me in the whelming flood. So he's introducing this really to get to the idea of the covenant. That's what he's going to spend pretty much the rest of the chapter talking about, is the covenant. But as we think about this, Jesus has a better ministry too. And I think he may be getting at this idea of him ministering in the new tent, the new tabernacle. Like, the work that Jesus is doing is more important than the work that those priests did. Now, if you think about being a Jew, like, if you weren't a Levite, or if you weren't an Aaronite, or the people of the house of Aaron, I don't know if they had a special name, but if you weren't one of those guys, imagine like thinking about that, like, wow, you get to like, your job is to go before God. And if you're the high priest, whoa, like Day of Atonement, you get to go where nobody gets to go except for you once a year with blood. And to think about the ministry that they had, and then to think about Jesus' ministry is so far greater than that. Going into God's very presence, coming from God's presence to earth, becoming a man, and then going into heaven itself, passing through the heavens. The veil is torn, his flesh, and he goes in with God. So his ministry is better. And so it gets us to this idea of a better covenant. And that's really where we're going to kind of spend the rest of our time tonight, is thinking about this idea of a better covenant. So, a new covenant. He's going to quote here from Jeremiah chapter 31. I wish we had time tonight to kind of go back to Jeremiah, because it's really cool. Like, the section of Jeremiah he quotes from is kind of a literary unit. And this is kind of the middle of that literary unit, and it's like really focused on, and it's really important. But Jeremiah is another study for another time. But his audience would know the passage he's quoting from. And when we read this, I want you to try to rewind in your mind to Jeremiah's day during the time of like the Babylonian captivity and stuff. And you're just used to like the old covenant's been going on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And to think about hearing this passage the way they would have heard it when Jeremiah spoke it. Not knowing, they just had the shadow, they didn't have the things to come. Kind of not knowing what's coming. Think about it from their perspective for just a minute. Let's pick up reading in verse 7. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, so rewind, think about this. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. This is one of, if not the longest, Old Testament quotation in the New Testament. Of course, the book of Hebrews is just chock full of Old Testament quotations, but this is the longest one that I know of in this book, and maybe even in the whole New Testament. So as we think about this idea of a covenant for just a minute, a covenant, we might define a covenant as an agreement that defines a relationship. Because sometimes when two parties agree on something, they make a what? What's another type of agreement that people make? They sign a contract, right? That's kind of another word that we use. What's the difference between like a covenant and a contract? There's some similarities for sure, that like there's kind of like two parties and they each agree to certain things and they like have some kind of sign that they say, okay, I'm going to be true to my part of this agreement, and that's it. But in a contract, really I think the focus is more on like the rules. Okay, it's like these are the stipulations, but like I kind of have this business relationship with you, and like I'm going to do these things if you'll do these things, but like my life is kind of over here. But this contract rules like our, like this area of our lives over here. And that's kind of it. Like it's just over here, it's a contract. So what's the difference between that and a covenant? So a covenant is made between two parties, and it defines them. It defines the relationship and really kind of the lives of like those two parties. When they make that agreement and enter into a covenant relationship, there's a belonging that happens there. That you're no longer just yours, but like you're in this covenant relationship. And so there's like things you can't do anymore because you're in a covenant. And there's things that you need to do because you're in a covenant. What's the most common, we don't talk about a covenant a whole lot, but what's the most common covenant that happens today? Marriage, right? And we have like a sign of that covenant and things like that. And that's not just like a contract, right? Hopefully your marriage doesn't work just like a contract that means that I do. You're like real careful about like the things you said on that day. Because it's like, well, if I didn't say it, it's not in the contract. No, like it's a relationship. And you say, I'm going to be true to you and I'm going to give myself to you. And you don't like go down the list and like say all the little things that you're going to do. I'm going to not do these things. Because it's a relationship. Like you're bound to that person for the rest of your days. And you serve them, and you love them, and you work on that relationship, and it grows. And like, that's what this is. It's a covenant, not a contract. And it's really important because I think sometimes it's tempting for me, and I think it's tempting for us, to think about God more in terms of a contract than a covenant. And we need to think about it in terms of a covenant relationship. So, he talks about this idea of a covenant. And it's a new covenant, which, by the way, we say new covenant and old covenant all the time when we talk about the Bible. But do you know what we say when we say it? Old Testament and New Testament. You know that that's the same exact thing? Like covenant is just another word for testament. So what we're really saying is the old, like open your old covenant to, you know, Genesis. And well, if you turn in your new covenant to the book of 1 Thessalonians, we're going to talk about and all of the new covenant. Like, and, but when we say testament, like we lose that a little bit. And in some ways, the old covenant is a little bit of a misnomer because like there was the Mosaic covenant that happened at Sinai. And like that wasn't the whole Old Testament. It was most of the Old Testament. But there was like some other covenants before that in the book of Genesis and stuff like that. But that's another lesson for another time. But just remember that when you say like Old Covenant or Old Testament, like that's the same thing. New Testament, New Covenant, same thing. So there's this new covenant and there's this prophecy about a new covenant. And Israel is just in turmoil at this point. The kingdom had been divided for this long time. And then Jeremiah is given by the Spirit this prophecy about there's going to be a new covenant. So let's just like walk through this real quick. And look at the nature of the new covenant from this prophecy made hundreds of years before this new covenant would take effect. How does he describe it? He says, the days are coming when I'm going to establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So the first thing about it is that it's what? It's new. It's not like the old. And he expounds on that in verse 9. It's specifically not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. God makes a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai. And there were like stipulations of that covenant. There are blessings and curses. And you can read through all of that in the Old Testament. And God says specifically, the new is not like that covenant. Now, are there some similarities? Absolutely. There's lots of things we can learn from that first covenant and the way that God worked in that first covenant. But the new is not like the old. It's fresh. It's new. Hit the reset button in your mind because there's going to be a different kind of relationship in this new covenant. So what's that going to be like? Well, in verse 8, he addresses it. Who's it going to be with? He's going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Now remember, in Jeremiah's day, that would have been kind of a weird concept. Because that northern kingdom of Israel had been gone for like a long time. They were taken away into captivity and like they didn't really hear from them much anymore. And so it's like, wait, like we're all going to be like back together again? I think the picture here is prophetically, he's not just talking about Jewish people, but he's going to gather all of God's people together again. In this new covenant, it's not going to be this divided kingdom. It's going to be a united kingdom again with all of God's people together. And of course, in the New Testament, we see several passages that talk about Christians being the new Israel, the spiritual Israel, the Israel of God, and Galatians and things like that. So what else is different about the new covenant? So in the old covenant, Moses comes down the mountain, and what does he have? He's got the Ten Commandments, right? And which, by the way, that was a covenant. Somebody pointed this out to me, that the Ten Commandments, we always think about, like, how are they written, right? So, like, you always see them. There's, like, the two, like, you know, circle on the top, shaped stones. I don't know how they knew they were shaped like that, but that's what they're always drawing it. And there's, like, 1 through 5 on this one and, like, 6 through 10 on this one, right? And 1 through 5 is, like, really long. And there's, like, the thou shalt nots are, like, over here. That might not have been the way that that was written. It may have been, again, doesn't say this explicitly, that all 10 were on this one and all 10 were on this one. And it's the idea of, it's a covenant. And in this sense, it was like a contract in that there's a copy for Israel and there's a copy for God. And with one copy, they put one copy where? In the Ark of the Covenant, right? And so it's kind of like saying, okay, God's copy of the covenant, our copy of the covenant. And really, it was for the people. Those were their ends of the contract, along with all the other laws that he gave. But it's the idea of a covenant again. So it was written on what? It was written on stone, on this physical outward reminder of here are the things, the do's and the don'ts of the law. Now, as we're going through this lesson, I want to be really clear. I'm not saying there are no do's and don'ts when we come to the new covenant. Like, I think there are some people who want to take that idea to an extreme and say, like, there is no law in the New Testament. Like, it's not about law. You can't turn to the New Testament and find a law section like Leviticus. And so there's just not this idea of law. And I'm like, so what about that, like, law of liberty and, like, fulfill the law of Christ? And, like, there are several sections in the New Testament. It's true. While it doesn't have, like, a rule book section like Leviticus, there are certainly still laws that we are under in our covenant relationship with God. That's part of that. And just like in a marriage, like there are rules, right? Within that marriage, like, you can't do these things. You can't go be with someone else. Like, there's do's and there's don'ts. But that's not what it's all about. It's there's the relationship, and the rules help you to maintain and nourish that relationship. So this new covenant, it's not written on stone, but where is the law written? It's written in their mind and in their heart. So it's not just like a law out here that is just like, okay, teach them this law. Like, you were born an Israelite, and so you got to learn. These are the rules if you're an Israelite. And so boom, boom, boom. And it's that everybody who enters into this relationship, to some extent, has already said, yes, Lord, I'm yours. Write your words on my heart. Put them in my mind, not through some like direct operation of the Holy Spirit, but through like meditating on them like Jesus did. He's tempted in the wilderness. Boom, there's God's words coming out. Like, it's written on his mind. It's written in his heart. And that's how we ought to be as new covenant people. That's what the prophecy said. Is like, people of this covenant, it's not just going to be like this thing out here, but it's written within us. And we need to live like that. We need to cherish God's words like that. Notice also in verse 10 that I'll put my laws in their minds, write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. This is covenant language that we're talking about right here. It's this belonging. And this phrase, you like Google this phrase or like Bible search this phrase, it's like all over the Old Testament when you look at it. I will be their God, they will be my people. I will be their God, they will be my people. And by the way, it's like undone Hosea, right? Like, not my people, no mercy. Like, it's, they would have been like, oh no, like, that's the covenant undone. It's reversed. And so this is the language, like, we belong to him. He is our God. He belongs to us and takes care of us and blesses us. And we are his people. We love him and serve him and obey his laws and spread his word. There's this relationship that was supposed to be happening in the Old Testament. And how well did it go? It did not go very well. And so, like, back in verse 9, he said, they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. And again, it's not saying that the Lord just, like, abandoned his people, but they broke the covenant. God was true to the covenant. They broke the covenant. We were talking about that recently in Micah, weren't we? With, like, the lawsuit that God brings, and he was faithful, 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 and they were unfaithful over and over again. So there's this idea of belonging to God. And you also see this like in the Song of Solomon, I am his and he is mine. This picture of belonging. It's that marriage language. It's that covenant language. So when you see that language, I will be their God, they will be my people, think covenant. Think like marriage type relationship is what we're talking about. In verse 11, it's kind of interesting. This confused me for a while. They shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. It's like, wait, I thought we were supposed to evangelize. But like, that's not what this verse is talking about. What is this verse talking about? They're not going to have to tell their brother and their neighbor saying, know the Lord, because everybody's going to know me. I think the idea here is that in the old covenant, how did you enter into that covenant with the Lord? How did most people enter into that covenant? You're born into it. Like, you just showed up in the world and you're like, congratulations, you're in a covenant relationship with Jehovah God because you are a child of Abraham and a child of Isaac and Jacob. And you're of this tribe, here's your job, go. And it wasn't like a very voluntary thing. It was just like, I was born an Israelite, and so I'm in this covenant relationship. And what kind of had to happen over and over and over and over again in Israel's history, particularly like in the book of Judges? People rose up, did not know the Lord. And they all did what was right in their own eyes. And the prophets had to come and say, know the Lord. Do you not know? He brought you out of Egypt and look what he's done for you and look, he's done this. And you don't know him because you're not living like you know him. And so they're not going to have to do that anymore in the new covenant, because how do you enter into the new covenant? You come to know the Lord. And it's not that you are done knowing the Lord once you enter into the covenant, but that's like the prerequisite. Like, you come to the covenant because you've heard about Jesus and you've heard about him and you say, yes, he's my Lord. I'm his servant. I'm yours. We have this covenant together. Bury the old me in the water because he's dead. I am yours now. I'm raised to walk in a newness of life with a new covenant. You're my God. That's the picture, is we've got this new covenant, this new relationship with God. And we won't have to tell each other to know God because everybody already knows him. Now, we're still coming to know him better, but we're not having to like reintroduce one another to the Lord. And finally, at the end of this prophecy, he says, I will be merciful toward their iniquities and I will remember their sins no more. The beautiful prophecy in this is that God is going to completely forgive these people. And that is how a covenant works, isn't it? That's how relationships work, isn't it? Is when, like, you're holding grudges and you're hurt by one another, there's not much of a relationship there. But what has to be removed for you to have that relationship? You forget all the things that they did to you. It's removed. It's gone. And so now you can enter into a covenant relationship because you're reconciled to them. There can be a relationship again. I don't want to overstate this, but forgiveness of sins is like so absolutely critical. But did you know that forgiveness of sins is not the ultimate goal for us? Like, the forgiveness of sins is like, it's the obstacle to the relationship. And so it's 100% necessary to remove the sin. But if that's all we focus on, it's just like, I don't know exactly what I could compare it to. It's like if you're separated from your fiance and you have to like get a visa to be in the country where they are or whatever, and then like you finally get all that worked out and like the thing separating you is done, and then you get there and you're like, yay, we're done. And then you just kind of like don't worry about the relationship because we overcame the distance, the separation, it's gone. Well, the reason you overcome the separation is to do what? To be with them and to be in a relationship with them, to work with them, to grow with them, to get to know them better. And so forgiveness is super, super, super important. I don't want to like sideline that, but understand that forgiveness is like just the removing of the obstacle so that we can then know the Lord even better and have a relationship with him and go to a place where there is no sin and there is no more obstacle with our relationship to him. Okay, that's just a really cool prophecy, and we're going to wrap this up very briefly here. So the Hebrew writer has really quoted this whole passage. We've gone into a lot more detail, but he's mainly focused on the fact that they didn't keep the covenant. Remember he said that back in verse 9? They did not continue in my covenant. And so when he introduced the quotation, he said, if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second, for he finds fault with them when he says, and he quotes Jeremiah 31, and then look at that. So his whole point is like, they messed up the first covenant, so now there's going to be this new covenant. And in verse 13, he says, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. He could mean a couple of different things in that verse. One thing he could mean is that when Jeremiah says there's going to be a new one, what you automatically start thinking about the current one. It's old. It's kind of, it feels obsolete. Like it's like that those times when like you start to think about buying like a new car or a new computer or something. And like once you start shopping for the new one and like you're thinking about which new one is it going to be, but like it's going to be a new one. How do you start to feel almost immediately about like the old one? It's like, well, it feels kind of like, okay, well, it's here, but it's only going to be here for a little while. Like we're really thinking more about the new one. And so that may be the idea. It may also be the idea that he's about to come and destroy one of the big symbols of that covenant. What was one of the big symbols that God had? I will be their God. They'll be my people. I will come and dwell in the midst of them. What's the symbol of that? The temple. And so he really may be getting them ready, getting them to brace themselves. It's becoming old. It's ready to vanish away. That may be also what he is referring to. Either way, those two things are true. Very quickly, just for us, do you think about your covenant with God? Ephesians chapter 5 compares Christ and his people to what? A husband and a wife. Do you think about that? Like you're in a covenant relationship, even if you're here and like you're not married, but you're a Christian. Are you in a covenant relationship? Absolutely. Like the New Testament, like doesn't talk a lot about our covenant with God, but it's there. It's there in a few passages, and it's there in principle in passages like Ephesians 5 that talk about husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her. But I want to think you to think about that. If we think about what a blessing it is to belong to God, that's also a sobering thing, isn't it? That like, I'm in a covenant. Like, this has to define my life. And like, I belong to someone. I am not my own. The time that the covenant comes up, do you know the time when it comes up, like in all three of the Gospels? One of the only times it comes up in the Gospels. When does Jesus talk about the new covenant? He talks about it when he's instituting the Lord's Supper. It's like, it's interesting. It says, take, eat. This is my, with the bread, it's my body. With the cup, he doesn't just say, this is my blood. I thought that's kind of interesting. I always think of it that way. But what does he actually say there? This is the blood of the covenant, or Luke's version has, this is the new covenant in my blood. And we just need to think in those terms. Like, what happened for us to have this relationship with God? What was the price paid for the covenant? The blood of Jesus the Christ. This is not just a cheap friendship or like acquaintanceship. This is a blood-bought covenant from the only Son of God. That's a sober relationship. And we're reminded of that relationship every first day of the week when we get together. And we all share in that covenant with the Lord. The one time that they shall be my God and, I will be their God and they will be my people, the one time that quote comes up in the New Testament, it's in 2 Corinthians 6. We don't have time to read all this tonight. But let me just encourage you that the encouragement there is he quotes that verse and he's applying it to Christians saying, you don't have any part with the stuff in the world. What fellowship has light with darkness or Christ with Belial? You belong to God. You're in a covenant relationship with him. He's your God. Be his people. Be true to your covenant relationship this week. As you think about that, if you're in a covenant relationship with God, be true to that covenant, like you'd be true in a marriage. And finally, nourish your covenant relationship. Again, forgiveness is the thing that it removes the barrier. It opens the door to be reconciled to God. Nourish that relationship. He describes that more in detail in Ephesians 5 with the submission of the wife, the care and the sacrifice of the husband. And that they're brought together to mutually care for one another and build one another up. God wants a relationship with us. It's mind-blowing. But he has done all of this so that we can share a new covenant with him. And it's so much better than the old one. It's helpful for the Hebrews, and that's helpful for us. that's the lesson tonight. Sorry, I've gone a little long, but I hope that's helpful to you. It's certainly been helpful for me to think about these things. And that's the invitation tonight, isn't it? It's an invitation to share a relationship with God. If you're here tonight and you're not in a covenant relationship with Him, realize the consequences of not being in a covenant with God. If you're not for Him, you're against Him. And there's coming a day when there's going to be a line drawn between those in the covenant and those outside of the covenant. And it's going to be forever. And if you're in that covenant relationship with God and you're struggling with fidelity, spiritual fidelity in that covenant, we want to pray for you. We want to help you. If there's any way that we can help you to make that covenant right tonight or to begin that covenant, let us know while we stand and sing this song.